Hello, I'm delighted to say that this episode of Film Stories is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it is a virtual private network, and it's a service that basically allows you to pretend that your computer or device is in a different country. So you set a virtual location for your device, and that means that suddenly you can get access to things that otherwise you might not be able to see. So for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you set your NordVPN to America, then you get a plethora of options from American Netflix rather than UK Netflix, which is where this podcast is based. You can do this with all sorts of things. You switch the virtual location of your VPN service, and then you get access to TV shows, to films, to sporting events, streaming services and such like that you just wouldn't be able to get from the UK. A quick mention too for the cybersecurity features of NordVPN, including shielding your online activities, encrypting your connection, and using threat protection as well. To take advantage of this, you need to go to nordvpn.com/filmstories. That's nordvpn.com/filmstories. And you can try it risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan. If you go to that Film Stories link, that will give you an extra 4 months free on top of the 2-year plan. And again, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. And you will also find the link in the podcast episode description box. Hello, this is Simon Brew. I'm the editor of Film Stories magazine, and a very warm welcome to the Film Stories podcast.
Come with me.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
In movies that had stories.
That the story just sucks them in.
This is just the beginning.
Film Stories.
We would be honored if you would join us.
Hello and a very warm welcome to Film Stories with Simon Brew. I am Simon Brew. As always, that's absolutely everything you need to know about me. The aim of the podcast, though, is given away by the title. I'm here to talk of the stories of films, and I tend to talk about production stories, marketing stories, development stories, release stories, all the ingredients really that go towards making the films that we know and sometimes love, just that, the films that we know and sometimes love. The films I tend to cover on this podcast lean more towards the mainstream than anything else. They're films I'm interested in or invested in to some degree. I try not to do snark. I try not to punch down. This podcast is a celebration of cinema and a real appreciation that somehow, films manage to get made. What you've happened upon here is one of my occasional episodes of the podcast where I bring in a filmmaker to talk about their latest release or their body of work. And in this case, you get a bit of both because I'm delighted to be joined by actor Dan Stevens, who is part of the ensemble for the imminent release at the point this is being released, Abigail, a new horror comedy drama. I'll let Dan Stevens explain it. Directed by Radio Silence, who just recently gave us 2 Scream films and the brilliant Ready or Not as well. We talk about a few bits and bobs just to give you the info you need to go in with, really. That one amongst the ensemble is Alicia Weir, who we most recently saw in the title role of the Matilda musical movie, so she's mentioned as well. The Eurovision Song Contest movie that Dan Stevens was in is called Eurovision Song Contest, the story of Fire Saga. I mentioned director Amy Heckerling. I don't say the film that they made together, which would be Vamps. Colossal, a film I absolutely adore from Nacho Vigalondo, that comes up in conversation. I briefly mentioned a film called The Rental, which was directed by Dave Franco as well. Tillman Singer has directed Cuckoo, which is just coming up in cinemas just in the coming months. And at the point this has been recorded, this was recorded as well, Godzilla X Kong, or Godzilla and Kong, directed by Adam Wingard, was the world's number one movie. Dan Stevens is in that film and has worked with Adam Wingard on The Guest, of course, which we don't directly talk about, but it comes up a couple of times during the conversation. He also mentions the VHS anthology movies. If you're unfamiliar with these are, as they sound, a bunch of films where each chapter in the anthology is directed by a different horror director, and Dan Stevens is making his way through those. But I think that's all you need going in. What I'm going to set this up with is... all you need going in. How much did I just read out there? What I'm going to set this up with is a clip from Abigail. A spoiler-free, really, clip from Abigail. No mean feat, as you're about to hear. And then the other side of this is my conversation with Dan Stevens.
Who's the girl?
You don't need to know her name.
I don't care about her name. Whose kid is she?
A very wealthy man who's about to be $50 million poorer. Look, You're safe here. And to be completely certain that you can't be tracked, I'm going to collect your cell phones.
Nobody's tracking me.
I'm not taking any chances. Give them over.
In the bag.
One second, I just gotta send this real quick. Thank you. Just, okay.
Thank you.
Keep the doors locked and the girl isolated. See you in 24 hours, my lovely pack of rats.
That was a clip from, well, that was a spoiler-free clip. Lord knows what I'm going to pick from Abigail. And I'm delighted to be joined by one of the stars of the film, Dan Stevens, who's joining me for a Film Stories podcast special. How are you, Dan Stevens?
Hello, how's it going?
Well, all right, thank you very much. I've met you once before at a junket for Beauty and the Beast, where you were drinking out of a sizable horn at the time. And so
can I double check
what your drinking receptacle of choice is for this particular film?
Today it's just a very sort of trippy mug designed by my friend Jen Stark.
Excellent. I hope you get kicked back on that. I don't, as a house, it's really hard to talk about this film because I went in to see it not having watched a trailer or read a synopsis. I knew absolutely nothing about it. You to do a little bit of, I think so as well. I'm a trailer avoider. Can I get you to do just a tiny bit of boring heavy lifting at the start? Can you tell me what you're comfortable with people knowing about Abigail?
If people haven't had enough of these already, it's a vampire ballerina heist movie, which is really all you need to know. It's a motley gang brought together to kidnap the daughter of a wealthy individual. They're hoping to make lots of money from this particular transaction, and this particular 12-year-old girl turns out to be a vampire ballerina. I think they knew she was a ballerina, but they weren't aware of the vampire bit.
The last time I saw her, she was Matilda.
We thought we were just kidnapping a musical theatre actress. But it turns out we were in for a lot more. All hell breaks loose in the house that they've got her sort of holed up in, and that's our movie.
So this is this is going out as audio. So what your description doesn't get across, first of all, is the quality of your mug, but secondly, the massive grin on your face as you're talking about it. So I kind of delved into the press notes for this, partly to see what you'd already been asked, but also just to kind of get a flavour of where everyone sits on it. And there's a lovely sentence in the press notes that tells me that your career is wildly varied. Isn't a perfect phrase? Wildly
is that
varied.
The phrase they use? Wildly varied. That. Well, that's
isn't that
I think
great?
That's fair to say, isn't it? The big grin on my face is partly because, you know, I don't know if this is in the press notes, but that Abigail is very much, in my mind, it's as much a comedy as it is a horror film. You know, that it's one of those, and Radio Silence, too, the director duo who directed this, Matt and Tyler, the tone of their films is something I really, really enjoy, which is where it's a horror where the gore is taken to such a batshit extreme that it becomes hilarious. My mind, and I think in the minds of some of the people who watch it, you know, my horror response generally is laughter. You know, I will sort of meet a particularly shocking moment in a horror film with laughter. It's always been the case with me. But with this one, you know, there's very obvious, you know, there's one-liners, there's funny back and forth. There's just sort of very funny situations that we put these characters in. I hope people enjoy it as much as a comedy as a horror film.
I think I can say this. I spoke to Lee Cronin after he'd made Evil Dead Rise, which was a similar thing. Went and picked a house out a million miles from Hollywood and drenched it in lots of liquid. I think I can get away with that. But he, as a just on a practical level, had to shoot that film chronologically because by the last act of the film, he had no way of cleaning it up and getting it back to where it was. Was it I'm treading like a spoiler light as I can, but was it fairly similar? Do you have to shoot this in a particular order to make it work?
Very much so. Yeah, I think we were almost the same situation. You know, there were certain sets that we, you know, the greatest art department in the world would never have been able to kind of put back to how it was. And we had, I'm told by Matt, the director, that we actually drained Ireland of its movie blood resources and had to have special shipments come
That's
in.
Amazing.
Because, you know, because this stuff is sort of specially formulated. It's kind of like a some corn syrup with a particular kind of dye that, you know, looks right on camera. And we used it all up. And so, you know, they had to ship more of this stuff in. And there were certain days where they would fill these sort of exploding cannons that would just plaster the entire set in, you know, bits and blood. And it was a real event, you know. And so each time we got to that point in the script, it was like, okay, well, this room's going to go now. And we'd all stand around and watch this thing absolutely, you know, go bananas all over the set and all over us as well. And as you know, most of us, as we go through the movie, we just change color completely because we're just caked in this stuff.
I'll credit the names that you've just briefly mentioned there. I know you did. If I just fill it in for listeners, it's Matt Bettinelli Olpin. I can't even say his name, and Tyler Gillett, the directors, but also the script from Stephen Shields and Guy Busick as well. And I'm curious. I mean, going back to that phrase about wildly varied career, what does your inbox look like? You know, because you've talked in the past about casting in the UK, and I mean, you're probably aware you did a major TV series in the UK, and I would imagine your inbox after that was very samey. But now, what do you get sent? I look at like the three or four films you've got coming out in a matter of months. I mean, you're the number one movie in the world as we're talking at the moment. And I just wonder if that, I mean, if that's reflected in what comes in now. Do you have any idea what's going to be on an email when someone sends it you?
I don't. And that's the delight, really. I mean, it's quite common that, you know, if you make it big in one thing, you know, do a great cowboy movie that's you know, number one at the box office that week, you're going to be sent a ton of cowboy movies. You know, it's just the sort of the way that studio executives' brains seem to work. But I've always kind of enjoyed the idea of slightly punking that system, which makes it can make it kind of challenging because it's like, well, nobody knows what to do with me. But at the same time, I enjoy the idea of a challenge. Like, you know, I particularly remember when like Eurovision came in and like no one was expecting that to land. And I could never have said that was something I was looking to do. But when someone says, how do you feel about, you know, playing a closeted Russian pop star, you know, absolutely, you know, and just like on any given day, you know, you can sort of present me with a particular kind of challenge and I sort of feel up for it. Sometimes it's defined by the last thing that you did. So if I played a particularly horrible character, you know, maybe the next thing I play, I don't want to be, you know, quite such a nasty guy. But, you know, I really sort of enjoy the variety. I enjoy the surprise because I don't know quite what I'm going to do next. And I hope audiences don't either, you know, that it's sort of becoming, it's not really a pattern because it's not a pattern. But, you know, that's sort of the point, you know, that it's like, well, we don't quite know what's going to happen, where he's going to go next.
So what point, when you got the mail with this, and again, it's a fairly boring question. I'm genuinely intrigued if there was a point where you were in, you know, just if there was one moment. I mean, was it the personnel behind it, or was there just a moment in the script, again, go spoiler light, where you just thought, I've just got to do it? Do you get that kind of visceral reaction to material?
Sometimes you do. Yeah. Sometimes it's, you know, it's very much in the writing. I mean, with this one, I would say it was, you know, particularly the filmmaker, it was filmmaker led, you know, that I knew these guys were fun. They were, you know, they make the kind of films that I enjoy watching, you know, that are, that you know, the sort of horror with very much a sort of comedic leaning. And that, you know, they're just sort of enjoyable things to play in. And so, yeah. And I'd never read anything quite like it. You know,
I believe
there aren't many vampire ballerina heist scripts that come into my inbox anyway. So, yeah, I think it was just the sort of playfulness of it, really, that it's very often that's a sort of common theme with stuff that I respond to, really, is that there's a kind of, that there's a playful element, and that can mean many different things, really, but it's like particularly playful within a genre or playful with an audience, that, you know, I sort of enjoy, I enjoy being a part of that enterprise, really, of kind of playing with audiences.
I wonder if Matt and Tyler hadn't directed Ready or Not, and you'd seen all the way through that they commit to it right to the last beat. I'm trying now not to spoil two films of it. Would you have had the confidence with this? Because, I mean, us on the outside, we see lots of stories of scripts coming in that by the time they've been through umpteen test screenings and umpteen executives, they've just been neutered somewhat. I can't see where the studio note is on this.
Yeah, I that's a great question. I mean, it's very hard to say what this would have looked like in someone else's hands, but I feel like they have, you know, it's a testament to them that they have done, you know, what is sort of unarguably their thing with it. You know, and I think the studio very much supported that. And, you know, bearing in mind, we shot this over the strike. So we were shooting up until July, then we downed tools for 5 months, and then we came back and we only finished it in December. You know, during that time, all sorts of questions flying around, you know, because we still had, I don't know how many days left to shoot, you know, I think there was sort of 15 shoot days, you know, and really the sort of finale of the movie. And it was a testament to them and to the studio that they basically sort of cut together the 70% of the film they had. And the studio loved it so much, they said, actually, we want you to go bigger with this final fight sequence, you know, because in this day and age, a studio could easily turn around at that point and be like, do you know what? Don't bother finishing it. We're not gonna put this one out or something, you know, given that there are now films that get fully finished and are never seen, you know. So I think we were all slightly holding our breath, and it was great that, you know, we got to come back to this with a real sense of like, oh no, this is kind of working. The tone is working. They really want something big from this climactic fight finale. And so we really got to kind of step into that final chapter with a sort of a real sense of confidence.
I mean, it's interesting. I remember Christopher McQuarrie on both of the last Mission Impossible films talking about how it was for different reasons, he got to take both of those films back into editorial for several months in the middle of the shoot, which is never built into the schedule, is it, at any point? And he thinks it monumentally improved both of those films. It sounds like, I'm not saying monumental, but it sounds like that level of improvement was able to be put into this as well, just by taking thinking time back, which I think digital editing has taken thinking time out of a lot of process, I think.
That's an interesting point. I mean, I don't know, it's certainly not possible with everything, and you know, and it's sort of part of, you know, it's part of filmmaking, really, but I think what I meant to say was that it just like it we all I think Matt and Tyler, but all of us sort of had a sense of validation, you know, as I say, rather than the, you know, the other extreme where the studio watch 70% cut and just like, let's shelve this, let's not bother, you know. And actually the other extreme really was true, where they were like, actually, here's some more money, go to town with this fight, you know, we want to finish this strong. And you know, because it was you know, it can be hard to come back to a shoot after, you know, a 5 month hiatus. It's, you know, it's unheard of, really. So it really gave a great energy to that final part of the shoot.
And was it a case that you did all decamp to a house in Dublin? Did you kind of take the Cocaine Bear route? Because Cocaine Bear was in Ireland as well, wasn't it? Just like,
that's right. Yeah. We had a lot of the same crew, actually, who I think.
Is that right?
Yeah, they were just, you know, they'd seen it. They thought they'd seen it all with Cocaine Bear, and then along came Abigail. You know, I mean, they must be. Yeah, like, what do we do to deserve this? No, they're an incredible crew, and there's so much fun, and you know, a really, really great atmosphere there, and it was this massive house just outside Phoenix Park on the edge of Dublin town centre. I think it had at one time belonged to the Guinness family. It was their sort of party house or something. It was just a really, really amazing place that had just sort of been left to ruin. And I think various film crews have sort of come in and done their worst with it. But I think we maybe, you know, take the prize for the actual worst that we've done with that place. And there's like an indoor swimming pool that we filled with all sorts of horrible things. And, you know, we really, you know, our art department had a great time on this. I mean, it was amazing coming in. And like you were saying, some days, you know, because very often we would have to shoot chronologically because of the sort of blood destruction. Yeah. But there were some days where you would come in and see an art department literally just sort of plastering a wall with bits of, you know, insides and blood and all sorts, you know. It's just like that was their day, was just sort of, you know, going in ahead of us and putting bits of intestine on a bookshelf. You know?
This is why I love film. It's just like you put Saltburn, for instance, and Abigail side by side. Two films where a bunch of actors decamped to different houses with very, very, yeah. very different results.
Doing very, very different things, as well. Yeah.
Do you do it with the rental for Dave Franco as well? Was that a similar
That's
thing?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, we did. I don't know if it was an Airbnb or a house that was being sold or something, but we took over this extraordinary house on the cliffs and you know, almost the entirety of the movie takes place there. And yeah, it does add a certain atmosphere to a shoot, I think. It's sort of, you know, it is like a movie camp or something.
See, the clickbait that's going to come off this podcast is Dan Stevens basically wrecks houses and Airbnbs. You know how the internet works. Just before you on this podcast was Dolph Lundgren. So you're a double bill with him. Really.
Amazing.
And he was saying something quite interesting about how he was on the, because he's just directed a film called Wanted Man, and he had 25 days to do Wanted Man, which he did pretty much in the aftermath of spending eight months on the set of Aquaman 2. And it's just, it strikes me, and it's a very odd parallel. I bet every other interview you do today will draw a parallel between you and Dolph Lundgren.
It's the first time I've talked about Dolph Lundgren today, but hopefully not the last. Not the last.
But I mean, he was quite interesting on it. Just the actor having to wait around on one film and then almost being unleashed on the next. And I don't quite know the chronology of Cuckoo, of Abigail and Godzilla. Do you say the X? I don't think you're supposed to say Godzilla X Kong.
Godzilla X Kong. I've just been calling it Godzilla and Kong. I think the key thing is that it's not versus anymore. They're collaborating.
Okay.
That's the sense we're trying to get from that one.
Godzilla loves Kong. Let's just call it that.
Yes.
But yeah. I mean, just from a pure acting point of view, one film presumably has a lot more weighting than the other. And I'm just wondering, just like where's your happy place? You know, do you when you're on the longer films, ache to do something quicker? When you're on the shorter films, do you ache to do something where you've got a bit more time?
I mean, I try to avoid aching in general. You know, I think
I'll
you know
that'll leave that
to my aging
first.
Knees these days. But I think, you know, I like to mix it up. You know, and I really love the atmosphere on something like Cuckoo, which is a, you know, like a very, very small indie film. You know, we've got a crew of, let's say, less than 50, you know, on set, yeah. You know. And then you go to something like Godzilla and Kong, where, you know, you've got a crew of 200, you know, many of whom you might never even meet. And so, yeah, there's one set where you know everybody's name and another where it's just like there's a whole village going on and you know, you've no idea, you know, what's happening half the time, and you're just sort of brought in for these little bits. And Abigail was sort of somewhere in between, I would say. You know, that it wasn't a massive crew, but it was, you know, a sizable budget. There's, you know, an incredible art budget, and you know, but it wasn't, I wouldn't say, a huge amount of sort of waiting around. I suppose on something like Godzilla and Kong, it's, you know, very often it's sort of technically you're waiting for a lot of sort of technical things to happen, but no, I mean, the waiting around is sort of I don't know, it can be filled with any number of things, if you know what I mean. If you've got, you know, if you're friends with the filmmakers, if you just, you know, you like hanging out at the Video Village and just sort of sitting around and chatting, it doesn't really feel like waiting around, really. Yeah. And you know, I would say, actually, with all of these filmmakers, really, it never felt like waiting around, because you're surrounded by great people. And, you know, if you happen to have to wait an hour for something to be constructed or deconstructed or covered in blood or something, you know, you just sit around talking about movies, or, you know, that's part of what I enjoy about what I do, really.
I mean, I should point out as well, you'll get, and I'm sure you know this too, you're getting a CinemaCon award, which from what I can work out, I mean, congratulations on that. Not least for being the actor who seems to be keeping cinema going in 2024 when there are virtually no other films about and they seem to be working. I mean, I just wonder, go back to the start of your career. When, you know, you're fight, because you talked about how you've talked in the past about how you were never comfortable with screen auditions and it always felt like very, very tricky to get in. I'm just wondering if you can contrast that with the person sat there getting an award off the cinema exhibitors for three very varied and each in their own ways impressive films.
It's delightful, you know, and it's a great honor to be receiving an accolade from those guys. And yeah, I mean, it's a strange sort of coincidence that, you know, as I say, I've been working away for, you know, a couple of years on these different projects, and they all seem to be coming out in the same season. I think, you know, auditioning is such an artificial process, and it's not one that I've ever really enjoyed, and I suppose, you know, I was sort of moderately successful at it, but never felt truly comfortable. I feel like self-taping is really, you know, it just doesn't feel, it never felt right to me. I don't know, you know, it's sort of become a thing. It used to be that you would at least go to an office and sit there with a casting director, and there would be a sort of a sense of event about it, but now just sort of, you know, just sitting in front of your phone reading lines, it's just sort of, I think I'm just terrible at it. And I think also because my appetite is so varied, and I knew that I had this desire to do such a range of things, that the idea of sort of trying to confine that to one take, you know, recorded on my phone, just I don't know, it felt very sort of hypothetical to what I wanted to be doing, really. So it actually has taken years of working in a variety of things, sort of laying out the stall in a way, to sort of show what I'm capable of, but also what I want to do and what I enjoy doing. And I think, you know, not to say that everything I've done has a sort of equal weight, but there are certain things that you can see that I've clearly really enjoyed doing that I would never be able to capture, you know, in a sort of a little camcorder in my bedroom, you know, in quite the same way.
Sort of related to that. I mean, going back to Dolph Lundgren, obviously, he clearly made one of the best films of the 1980s. I mean, Rocky IV is peerless. Oscars all ran. You're in one of my favourite films of the 2010s as well, a film not enough people talk about, Colossal, which I think is an extraordinary piece of work. But it took me down a bit of a rabbit hole just searching for the directors who you seem to be seeking out, because Nacho Vigalondo, I don't think, has directed another film since Colossal yet. I think he's got one coming. But you're working with people like Gareth Evans, Amy Heckerling straight after Downton just seemed like a brilliant, brilliant handbrake turn. And then, of course, there's Adam Wingard with the guest. So, you talk there about what you want to do, but is it also who you want to do it with? Are you actively seeking some of these relationships out? Because, Nacho Vigalondo, just, you have to look for, don't you? I mean, it's quite hard to come knocking at your door.
I think, you know, and Nacho Vigalondo directed one of my favourite films, Time Crimes, which is just an absolutely brilliant piece of work. And again, Tilman Singer, with his previous, Tilman Singer directed Cuckoo, his last film, Loose.
Yes.
I put in a similar kind of world to Time Crimes in a way, in that it's like clearly made on a budget, it's clearly made with limitations, but there is so much inventiveness. So what you're watching is the creative brilliance of the filmmaker. You're not watching budget, you're not watching, you know, money on screen, you're watching a brilliant filmmaking mind at work. And I love that when you see that. And it's not to say that a budget, you know, will necessarily ruin guys like that. It can be the case sometimes, but generally, you know, if you want to know whether someone is a great filmmaker or not, you want to see their early stuff. You know, you watch Adam Wingard's movie Pop Skull, which is bonkers, you know, but it was literally made, like, he made it almost entirely on his own with his mate Lane. And it's mad. And you just sort of think, oh, I want to get to know the person who made this film, and I want to see what they can do with, you know, with more. And so then, you know, Your Next came along, and then he gets to make The Guest, and, you know, so I'm, you know, I'm excited by great filmmakers, just period, you know, and kind of, I like the weirdos. I like, you know, the guys with sort of, you know, unusual tastes. But, you know, Amy Heckling, you know, was just someone who, I guess she is a weirdo, you know, she's, you know, a sort of a very sweet weirdo. She's not a sort of a horror, yeah, a horror weirdo, but she's got such a kind of delightful sensibility about her. And I just adore her. And, you know, we're still friends. We still meet up when I'm in New York and, you know, and just talk movies, and, you know, she's great. And so, yeah, I it's funny. A lot of the guys I've worked with, it seems, have had something to do with the VHS anthology horror.
Yeah.
So Gareth Evans, the Radio Silence, Nacho was involved in that. Yeah. Adam was involved in that. Simon. So I'm slowly ticking off those guys, you know, but again, I think it's sort of, that was a great showcase, you know, back in the day for these up and coming filmmakers to make these, what were essentially little sort of standalone shorts, you know, with a limited budget, but just sort of really showcasing extreme creativity and really sort of mad tastes and sensibilities. And, you know, I haven't deliberately been going through that list, but it came up when I was talking to the Radio Silence boys. It's like, you've worked with almost all of those sort of VHS guys. And yeah, I really, you know, I like their vibe.
So I mean, associated to this podcast is a print magazine of which I've just put 13 independent British films on the front cover. And in doing so, I've talked to the 13 individual British filmmakers who are trying to get stuff going. And the unifying factor between lots of them is it's really hard just to get eyeballs on their stuff. That just trying to get people to see your material in the first place. So I mean, it's almost gladdening really to hear you saying you're almost looking for things. But I'm just wondering.
Yeah, I mean, I love
when
a film,
I say looking
a
for
film
things,
festival,
I'm not
going to
fill your inbox with. Yeah, but you know, how are you finding some of the stuff you're doing? Because you're one of the people with profile who's actively seems to be seeking the left field stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it helps to be surrounded by a great team who are also, you know, who get your tastes, who are also looking out for these filmmakers. But I love a good film festival, whether I'm there or not. You know, I mean, I love going to film festivals, but if I'm not able to attend, very often you get coming out of those things, you know, something will pop and someone will send you a link to something. And it's a great way of discovering, you know, new talent, really, and new voices. It is hard. It is hard getting people to see stuff. But, you know, I love that sense. Like with Tillman, you know, he's made one film that is pretty universally admired by people who are into the genre. And, you know, I was just felt so lucky to be able to work on his second film, you know, and the same with Adam. Yeah. It's like he hadn't made that many films before The Guest, you know, whatever you think of those films, it's like getting to work with someone who you feel confident is a great filmmaker, who's going to go on and do great things. And, you know, I had never dreamed that like working on The Guest would yield Godzilla and Kong 10 years down the line and we'd be top of the box office,
you
know.
I
mean, it's not deliberate, but it's lovely when that comes around, you know. And I there's many of those filmmakers who I would hope to work with again, because it's exciting when you've got that shorthand and that trust. I think it is, you know, it's exciting to sort of find those people, really. And, you know, of course there's that list of, you know, 20 great filmmakers that we'd all love to work with and that are the sort of the most famous names in the world, but, you know, join the queue, you know, there's hundreds and thousands of people who want to work with those people. But, you know, not everyone's heard of Tillman Singer, but they're going to, and they're, you know, they're going to be enjoying his films for many, many years. And so, you know, I'm just excited that I get to work with these people as they're kind of developing their skill set and building that sort of, you know, building that body of work.
When Tillman makes Godzilla Loves Kong in about 15 years' time, which is what you're first on the call sheet, presumably. I'm pretty sure I'm almost out of time. I do just want to ask this though, if that's all right. What's the film that you're not asked about that you wish people would ask you more about? Because down your really interesting collection of movies that you've done, and Colossal is always the one that comes out to me. But is there one that we all ignore that we should be having a few more eyeballs on?
That's a really good question. I can't think right now. What would I say? I don't know. I sort of you know, I'm just delighted. Like when you brought up Colossal, and you know that's not one that people bring up that often. Although it is another kaiju movie.
I spotted that.
Yeah, gosh.
I'm asking you to choose one of your children.
People
can't answer this. So I'm not setting traps for you.
Off the top of my head, I will say. A film I did with Rebecca Hall, directed by Brian Craner, called Permission. That we filmed in New York a few years ago. That I really, really enjoyed. I think it's a lovely film, and it's been in my mind recently because I got to work with Rebecca Hall again on Godzilla and Kong that. in a very different kind of capacity. Great question. Gosh, I'm going to go and be thinking about my back catalogue for the rest of the day now.
Excellent. Dan Stevens, congratulations on Abigail in particular, which is a film I managed not to spoil, I think, and hopefully people go into it with as closed eyes as I did to it. And the very best to you. Keep making all these offbeat films.
Thank you, Simon. All the best. Cheers.
Take care.
And that brings me to the end of my conversation with Dan Stevens. Abigail, at the point this podcast has been released, is now playing in cinemas around the world. I've really, really enjoyed Abigail. You can find my review of that on the Film Stories website, filmstories.co.uk, or on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/filmstories. You can find more from me on Twitter and Blue Sky at Simon Brew, more from the entire Film Stories project on Twitter and Blue Sky at Film Stories. If you go to Facebook, we're at facebook.com/filmstoriesonline. We have a website, filmstories.co.uk. It's updated every weekday with movie news, reviews, features, games, TV. We are making it a clickbait-free entertainment website. Thank you to everybody who supports that. If you go to store.filmstories.co.uk, you can find our print magazines for sale as well. I briefly mentioned one of them. It's a very subtle plug in that interview with Dan Stevens. You can find it at store.filmstories.co.uk. And if you like this podcast and don't mind supporting it, please do leave a hugely positive review. Please do subscribe, and if you're really enthusiastic and have a few pound coins in your pocket, head to patreon.com/simonbrew. If you back the podcast there, first of all, I can say the word podcast correctly. Secondly, you get the podcast early pretty much every time, and you get it ad free as well. But I think that's enough for this special episode. Thank you as always for listening, and thank you for your time. I will be back soon with another episode of Film Stories. Until then, you all look after yourselves and stay safe. Thank you. Bye bye.